this is Alton Brown, and welcome to the Alton Brown Cast, a recording from a small padded room above my garage in Atlanta, Georgia. Today on the show, we're going to do, well, kind of the stuff that we usually do. We're going to take a look at food news items from the week, and we're going to break those down, analyze them, but mostly just make fun of them, especially if somebody's done something really, really stupid. We're also going to take some calls live from listeners out in the world that still have telephones. We're also going to answer some questions off of the internet. They come in through our kind of constant revolving email door of culinary inquisitiveness, if that's even a word. And you can reach us there at askalton@altonbrown.com. And, you know, if you are clever, especially clever with your question, we'll answer it, or at least we'll try to answer it. We're also going to have an interview today, and I'm very, very happy to say that I hate doing introductions, and this person doesn't need one. We're going to be talking to Bobby Flay. Actually, I'm contractually obligated to say Iron Chef Bobby Flay, who I guess I've known now for almost 15 years, which is kind of shocking because I've gotten older and my hair's fallen out and my face has gotten wrinkled, and he looks exactly the same as he did when I met him in 1999. So maybe we'll find out how that works. Today's food for thought is an Italian folk saying, and one of my favorites. And I actually can say that I heard this first when I was going to school in Italy for part of my college. And it goes like this: even an old boot tastes good if it's cooked over charcoal. Damn right it does. Food for thought. Alton Brown here. You're listening to the Alton Brown Cast, and this is the section of the show where we deal with some news items that we're following in the world of food. And this one comes to us through Eater, and let's see, the writer is actually was Hillary Dixler, and this story comes out of Campbell, California, and also, actually, I'm not sure if it's Campbell or San Jose. That is where the locations of a place called Psycho Donut are. Okay, now Psycho Donut, the guy that apparently runs Psycho Donut got himself into some hot water with some local animal rights people, and here's the deal, okay? In the state of California, apparently it is illegal to sell foie gras. Foie gras, of course, the fattened liver of certain types of duck and geese, depends on how you go about doing it. You can't sell it. It's not legal. However, because of a strange loophole in the law, you can give it away. You can give it away. And so the guy that apparently owns Psycho Donuts decided on National Donut Day, which was just recently passed, decided to give out free donuts filled with foie gras. All right, he had a donut. He piped it full of foie gras, topped it with crispy sage, injected it with fig, honey, I think some balsamic vinegar went in there. Anyway, he called it the foie bomb. Now, here's the interesting part, is that he got death threats. He received death threats. So I can understand people maybe being upset, animal rights people being upset. But look, if you're worried enough about life to not want a goose or duck to be force-fed grain in order to grow a really big liver, wouldn't you not threaten to kill somebody? I mean, it's just it just seems logical to me. If I cared about ducks and geese that much, I would also care for human beings enough to not actually threaten to kill them. Just food for thought, kids. That's all. Food for thought. Looking at a piece from the Huffington Post written by David Caruso leads me to believe that we have not heard the last of the large soda ban in New York City. Of course, New York's mayor, Mayor Bloomberg, is just crazy about food legislation. He wants to legislate you to health, New Yorkers. And a recent study apparently shows that, and this is from the New York City Health Department, shows that diabetes has reached an all-time high, almost doubling in the last 20 years in New York City. And Thomas Farley, who's the health commissioner there, has linked that problem to obesity being the heart of the epidemic, as he called it, and that's a quote. And I mean, that makes complete sense. But then he goes on to say that he blames that to the widespread consumption of sugary drinks. So diabetes on the rise, the cause of obesity, sugary drinks. So although a court did strike down the rule that Mayor Bloomberg attempted to put in place, basically making sodas over 16 ounces illegal, I bet that we're going to see some return action to that now that this has gone as loaded. This is going to probably happen. And I got to tell you, if you want to know what's going to happen to laws in this country when it comes to food and what foods you're allowed to eat and not allowed to eat, look to New York City, because Mayor Bloomberg's got it in for, I mean, you know, what's next? That's all I'm saying is I think we need to think about what's next there. Elaine Watson from Food Navigator USA, which is one of the first places that I go when I'm looking for food news items here in the United States. A recent piece, it's really kind of surprising, says that a new analysis of where Americans are getting their calories from turns out to to prove us kind of wrong. For a long time now, we've thought, or a lot of people that study this kind of thing, have thought that that most Americans get their calories, or the bulk of their calories, are coming from things like fast food and eating out, quick service restaurants, pizza, that kind of thing, and even, you know, vending machines, but places outside. But the truth is, as it turns out, people are getting a majority of their calories from foods that they buy at the grocery store, specifically store-sourced breads, grain-based desserts, pasta, and soft drinks. It says overall analysis of three different sets of data from 2003 and 4, 2005 and 6, and 2007 and 8 shows that 63 to 76% of calories in the U.S. diet, depending on age group, are from products bought at stores, while quick and full-service restaurants contribute only 17 to 26% of calories. That is pretty interesting. It says teens. This is cool. Teens get 17.5% of their calories from quick-service restaurants, that is fast food, and 7% from full-service restaurants. Adults aged 70 or plus obtain more than 76% of their energy from grocery stores. So, you know, the older you are, the more you you tend to shop. But of course, they've got, you know, the senior citizen bus coming and taking them, you know, on Wednesday to the market. I've seen that happening before. Ooh, and here's another reference. It says, as for soda, a hot button political issue is New York City Mayor Bloomberg is still trying to push through his soda ban. It says that energy intakes from sugar sweetened beverages were actually very low at 1 to 1.4%. Now that's interesting because it flies in the face of what New York City is saying, which is that the diabetes epidemic is related directly to obesity. That part's fine. And that obesity mostly can be blamed on sugary drinks. Well, this study says, no, we're only talking about 1 to 1.4%. Very, very interesting. Somebody's going to have to get down to the bottom of these figures and what they actually mean. Good luck to them with that. Here's a news flash from our own newsroom, and I'm the writer of this. Watermelon Oreos, yeah, they're disgusting. Just wanted you to know. So those of us that keep up with what's going on with GMOs and specifically kind of the ongoing war against companies like Monsanto, who are developing genetically modified organisms for agriculture, you might remember that I was speaking in the last podcast about the fact that this field in Oregon just all of a sudden had genetically modified wheat in it that was apparently part of a test or a trial that was done by Monsanto years before and abandoned because there wasn't enough of a market for it. And the fact that this stuff turned up, I said that there were going to be some financial ramifications that did indeed come to pass. American grain prices went down because, of course, some of our foreign buying partners like Japan don't want to mess with this stuff and are very concerned about it, and so it drives down the prices. They, of course, believe that we can't control our technology. Monsanto now saying that sabotage was likely in this case, and that the fact that this unapproved genetically modified wheat is found in this Oregon field is highly suspicious. And by the way, I'm reading from Ian Berry at the Wall Street Journal. Wall Street Journal, I trust that, says that instead of it being dispersed throughout the field, it was in one place, and that indicated the contamination of seed supplies in the region did not, wasn't really a possibility, because if it had been in the seed, it would have been, you know, everywhere. So what they're thinking is that somebody actually did this and did this on purpose. So if that's the case, is this bioterrorism? Because it's not just sabotage. Anyway, they're saying here that somewhere along the line, someone lost track of the material. Mr. Berry goes on to say that cases of sabotage of crops by anti-GMO protesters date back at least to the 1990s. So what's interesting here is that if this is true, and that if people that are actually anti-GMO are somehow getting their hands on these products and planting them to undermine the companies that made them, then they're actually doing the thing that they were afraid was going to happen, but that didn't. So it's stupid, okay? If I'm really worried about GMOs being released out into the world, the last thing I'm going to do is release GMOs out into the world. It doesn't make any freaking sense, which just goes to show that there's crazies on both sides of this. Here's a vital little bit of food news. This comes from Vanity Fair, which we don't often get, you know, vital food news from, but what the heck. They have released their list of top 10 best dressed celebrity chefs. And this is pretty important stuff because I'm number two. Who the heck beat me? I'll tell you who beat me. Anthony freaking Bourdain. Now, I like Anthony Bourdain. I've hung out with Anthony Bourdain. He's good by me. But hey, the guy like wears schlumpy sweaters and cargo pants. How does that get best dressed compared to a guy that owns 210 bow ties? I just want to know. So anyway, Anthony Bourdain smoked me. Then there's me. And then Jada De Laurentiis. I get a lot of joy out of that because the contents of Jada's closet cost more than my house. After that, Marcus Samuelson, who I think actually has several lines of his own clothing. Jeffrey Zakarian, I bet that burns you, doesn't it, Chef Zakarian? Burns you, doesn't it, that you were that far down under me? David Chang, who is a snappy dresser. Katie Lee, that's ex-Mrs. Billy Joel. She certainly got the money to buy good clothes. Nigella Lawson, Sam Talbot. I don't even know who that is. I'm sorry. I got to look that up. And Thomas Keller. And I got to tell you, Thomas Keller is a classy guy. But there you have it. I'm number two. And gosh darn it, I know what I'm going to do next year. I'm gonna beat that Anthony Bourdain if it's the last thing I do. USA Today has published an article about junk food in schools. Apparently, there is some stuff that's actually really going to happen about junk food in our schools. Government announces new standards for snack foods not part of regular school meals. And this is going to be beginning of the 2014-15 school year. Quoting USA Today, Nancy Helmick, who says, "Goodbye donuts, candy bars, high-fat chips, full-calorie soft drinks, and chocolate sandwich cookies. Those kinds of foods and beverages will no longer be allowed to be sold in school a la carte lines, vending machines, and snack bars during the school day." So apparently all of these foods, the government is going to require that they be replaced by things like granola bars, nuts, fruit cups, light popcorn, flavored water that doesn't have calories in it, and that sorts of things. The program is apparently going to be called Smart Snacks in School. And it's funny, these rules, they're really trying to be lenient here, I think, which makes some sense. They don't apply to foods sold at after-school fundraisers, concession stands, sporting events, or other after-school activities. And they don't, of course, affect the foods the kids bring with them from home and lunches because you can't, you know, regulate that. So anyway, here's some of the new nutrition standards. All of these, quote, competitive foods, that is foods that these kids can buy a la carte, can't contain more than 200 calories for snacks and side dishes, no more than 350 calories for entrees that are not part of the school meal program. They've got to meet requirements for fat, saturated fat, and sugar. They can contain no trans fats. That won't be too hard to do. Some exceptions on the fat limits, I thought this would happen, be allowed for foods such as reduced fat cheeses and nuts, because of course they've got pretty high fat contents. Nuts, I'm certainly not going to worry about. Let's see, it's got to either be a fruit or vegetable, dairy product, protein food, or whole grain rich grain product. I like that, whole grain rich product, for a combination food that contains at least 1/4 cup of fruit and vegetable. For the first 2 years after the standards go into effect, foods can qualify as a competitive food if they contain at least 10% of a nutrient that's been designated as a public health concern for children, such as calcium, potassium, vitamin D, or fiber. So they're obviously trying to get some more of these into our kids' diets. You know, you look at this in practical terms. These standards mean, you know, schools aren't going to be able to sell high-fat chips, cookies, but they might sell low-fat chips and granola bars instead. Oh, and they can also sell sugar-free gum. I'm not a big gum fan. I always ends up, you know, like in the carpeting in the minivan. I really hate that. So anyway, I think that's a step certainly in the right direction. You know, here's the thing. If we can educate kids to not expect junk food every time they get a little bit of an urging, then maybe we'll be thinner adults. Recording remotely from New York City, which is where I had to come in order to catch up with Iron Chef Bobby Flay. How many people call? Do people around the world actually ever sometimes say Iron Chef Bobby Flay?
Very few, but yes.
But Chef.
I'm Bobby.
Bobby.
Yeah.
Do most people just still call you Bobby?
Yeah.
Bobby, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Most Americans know you as a chef, but you've actually had an interest in horses going back equally as far as food, right? Because you cut school and went to the track.
Maybe even beforehand. My grandfather took me to Saratoga when I was like 12 or 13 years old.
What was it like then?
Well, it's exactly the way it is now.
Because it's nice. Saratoga's
beautiful.
We're talking about Saratoga
Springs, New York, mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful place. It's the oldest racetrack in America. I think it's 1890. It's actually, well, they're celebrating their 150th year anniversary this year. The only reason why I know that is because I'm now on the board of the New York Racing Association. I was appointed by Governor Cuomo. And so it's 150 years old, and it's just a magical place. And it really isn't any different today as it was 30 years ago when I started going. And I've been to Saratoga every August, every year since, at least once.
But your grandfather took you.
My grandfather took me, and he got me interested. But then when I was in high school, and I realized that I did not like high school, we would cut and go to the track. We'd go to Aqueduct or Belmont, you know, either in Long Island or in Queens. We'd go racing instead of schooling.
Did you always bet, or were you there because you liked?
No, we were betting. We were totally betting. Okay. You know, we'd take our, you know, $15 and try to make a fortune. Obviously, that didn't happen.
Well, I don't know. How'd you do? Did you have an eye for it? Did you do better than most?
We had an eye for it, but basically, it's hard to win money. You can beat a horse race. You can't beat horse racing. But it's,
well, what do you mean?
Well, I think the thing I love about handicapping a race is it's like a puzzle. It's not like going up to a blackjack table or a slot machine and saying, hit me, or just kind of pulling a slot machine and hoping for the best. When you look at a race, you know, there's not anywhere between, let's say, 6 and 12 horses for the most part. And it's a puzzle. It's like you look at their past performances. You try to figure out how they're going to run, how the race is going to unfold. Who's riding the horse? Who's training the horse? You know, what did the horse do last time? Is the horse running on grass? Is the horse running on dirt? Does he like one better? What's the track conditions today? I mean, there's lots of variables. So I really think of it as a puzzle. It's like, to me, it's a crossword puzzle. And when you go to the races, you have 9 a day, approximately. And so you can definitely beat a day of racing. But I think that if you bet every day over time, most people have a very difficult chance of actually coming out on top. And so I always... You know, obviously it's a leisurely thing for me, and it should be for everyone.
You've had horses take some big purses.
Yeah.
Do you remember, tell me about the first time that happened.
Well, the biggest race I've ever won was the Breeders' Cup in 2010 with a horse named More Than Real.
More Than Real.
And
you don't own More Than Real anymore.
I sold her. She's now residing in Australia. The business has so many layers. The general public really has no idea. There's so much to it in terms of breeding and pedigrees and families that, you know, I would say that most Americans only know that there's a race once a year called the Kentucky Derby.
Or maybe three. There's the Triple Crown,
and
that's it.
But yeah. The Derby for sure has got the sort of, you know, the star power, so that, you know, a lot of people watch the Derby, you know, over...
I think it's kind of a trashy race, actually.
Somebody described it to me as like if Ascot and NASCAR crashed into each other.
that's a pretty picture.
it's really kind of true, actually, because there is, you know, there's both sides of it. But it's a great American sporting event. They get 150,000-160,000 people at Churchill Downs every year. And, you know, it's the Kentucky Derby. I mean, it's the race that most people in racing want to participate in. It's not my goal. If it happens, it would be my mistake. And the reason that is because the Kentucky Derby is basically for colts only, although fillies do have run in it and have won, but very rarely. And I mostly buy fillies because I'm in the breeding business. And I want to own the fillies for the rest of their lives, and I want to breed from them and create families from them. And so I participated in the Philly version of the Kentucky Derby called the Kentucky Oaks.
Which some people consider to be a more prestigious race in a way, right?
Well,
it's more elegant. It's more sophisticated,
If you live in Kentucky, that's Kentucky's race. They call it Oaks Day.
Oaks Day.
And it's Friday as opposed to Saturday, mm-hmm. which is the Derby.
Derby Day.
And everybody from Kentucky goes to Churchill Downs on Oaks Day. And then they sort of clear out and let the rest of the world come to the Derby on Saturday.
They go home.
Yeah, they go home.
So tell me about the win.
Well,
with More Than Real.
The Breeders' Cup is basically the world championships of racing. It's about 30 years old now. And there's, I think, 12 or 14 races. And they're by divisions. You know, so it's like juvenile grass horses. And, you know, and it kind of moves up the ladder. The races are between $1 million and $5 million purses. They're very, very well stocked in terms of purses. And
where does that money come from, by the way?
Well, it comes from a couple of different places. It comes the most of the money comes from nominations, which means that when you breed a horse, now the horse is born, okay? So in the first year, you can put up between $300 and $500, depends on which year it is, but to nominate the horse to the Breeders' Cup. Now, if you don't nominate the horse to the Breeders' Cup, the horse can't run in the Breeders' Cup. And it's important for you to nominate your foals to the Breeders' Cup for that little amount of money, because when you try to sell the horse, the person buying the horse wants to know that the horse actually has a chance to participate in the Breeders' Cup if the horse is successful enough. Or if you're going to race the horse yourself, you want to be able to participate in the Breeders' Cup if the horse is good enough. Because
so why don't you just nominate every horse?
You do.
Okay.
There you have it. So it fills a big pot of money. There's also sponsorships. You know, people like Grey Goose, Sentient Jet, you know, they sponsor the Breeders' Cup. And then also there's a admission fee to the race. It used to be 3%. We just lowered it to 2% this year. So if you were going to run in a $1 million race, you would have to put up $30,000.
Just as an entry fee.
Yeah. So that's how the purse is. But then what happens is not only do you take down the purse, your horse becomes really valuable. Incredibly valuable.
Like 10 times the original value?
No, it depends what it is. Okay. I mean, like for instance, when More Than Real won, she might have been worth, you know, $200,000 or $300,000 maybe. Let's say $200,000. On the high side, and then she won the race, so the purse was $1 million, and as a winner, you get 60% of that. So she gets $600,000 into her coffers, and then she probably becomes worth $750,000 to $1 million right away.
Boom.
In the racehorse business, basically what happens, if the horse runs well, the horse is worth money. If the horse doesn't run well, the horse isn't worth money, right? But in the breeding business, if somebody in the horse's family does well, then your horse becomes worth more money just by standing there.
Because the bloodline, this connection.
Exactly right. So I own a filly. Her name is Countess Lemonade that I bought in England, and she has a great pedigree. I bought her 2 years ago. Her brother just won the English Derby on Saturday, which is the most important race in the world, period. It's more important than the Kentucky Derby from a global standpoint. Mm-hmm. Now, my filly, now her value is who knows what it's going to be, and her foals will be worth X more money. And so it just kind of it kind of multiplies. And she didn't even get out of her stall that day. You know what I mean? But her brother did, and her brother won the most important race in the world. So because of that, her family and her bloodlines become worth a lot more money.
When you're breeding, your philosophy has been own fillies so you can have foals, make more horses.
Right.
Is that a long-term investment that's better than just owning stallions? Because I assume that horse that won the English Derby has a brother someplace whose stock just went up as well.
Yeah, exactly. You think about it like real estate. It's a long-term investment that takes a long time to come to fruition. But if it does, it's probably a really nice payoff. And most importantly for me, I enjoy it. It's fun. So it's way more interesting than buying a piece of real estate for me.
You've lived a majority of your adult life. Hell, you've lived all your adult life as a celebrity, basically. A good bit of it. I mean, you were a celebrity when I was going to culinary school, okay?
That was
95, 96. Do people in the horse trade give you any, I don't want to say, it's not grief, but are you treated as much as a celebrity when you're in that world as you are when you're out here in the general population and in the food crowd?
I mean, somewhat. And I think that what I've tried to do is use some of the notoriety that I have in the sort of mainstream world to help the horse business from time to time, whether it's from getting the word out that this it's a great sport and people should participate in it, to getting people to pay attention to, you know, thoroughbred retirement in the right way.
Animal welfare.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, the Governor Cuomo putting me on the board of NYRA to make New York Racing Association a better place to be. So I think that in those kinds of ways, yes, I think that my sort of notoriety in the chef world or in the food world has definitely helped me help the horse business a little bit, you know. 20,000 to 30,000 foals, thoroughbreds that are born in the sort of racehorse environment, and some of them go on to become champions and on and on. But only a few, you know, only a few really do, and then they have careers afterwards as stallions, you know, for stud farms, and then you know, on the filly side, you know, there's definitely an aftermarket value for them as well, because you can breed to them. But that doesn't encompass every single one, especially for the colts that don't make it as great horses and they're not stallions. What happens to them? Well, that's where places like the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, and there's something called the Grace and Jockey Club, that they either you know, it's called repurpose them. In other words, give them a different kind of career as jumpers or, you know.
How many kind of career opportunities are there?
I mean, a lot. They can be workhorses. They can be pets. They can be riding horses. They can be jumpers. They can be hunters, whatever, you know. Horses have lots
of work.
Exactly, horse work. And not just, you know, being at the racetrack. I mean, horses do love to run. And so it's probably the funnest thing that they do. But there are other things that they obviously can be used for. There's actually a program for prisoners where prisoners take retired racehorses and they basically it becomes their project to kind of take care of them. And it's worked incredibly well, and it's given, you know, a lot of inmates sort of a new lease on life, in fact. And so
the horses and the people.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, you know, it's my feeling that if you can afford to be in the racing business – you can be and you should be responsible for the life of that horse from the minute you either breed or buy the horse forever. It should be your responsibility. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't take that same tact.
So they take the cream and dump the rest.
Yeah, exactly.
Get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that your involvement in this has provided a counterbalance for the rest of your professional life as a chef and as a restaurateur?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of what I talked about before, which was that, you know, getting up and going to the barns in the morning, there's no one around, really. There's no crowds. There's no stoves. there's no employees not calling in sick. It's basically me and the horses and some of the horse people who are working there. And to me, that's the part I enjoy most. And it really does take me away.
I was given a speech, and they wanted me to talk about the effects of food shows on culture. Why is it that cooking and food has become a spectator phenomenon?
Oh, because America is ready for it. I always say we're the last country to catch up to the rest of the world. I mean, everybody else had a food culture that everyone cared about. Mm-hmm. We didn't. Even today, I mean, if you talk to a lot of people, like, they think American food is, you know, macaroni and cheese and hot dogs and hamburgers. And, you know, obviously we all know that it's such a much more diverse cuisine. We have, you know, wonderful pockets of regional cuisine all over this country, and it's amazing. I think that we were ready for food acceptance, and I think that the Food Network brought it into the mainstream. You know, before the Food Network, of course, it was Julia and the Galloping Gourmet, which I watched all of. And
sure, Graham Kerr in the original incarnation.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember that very well.
I mean, he had the best job. He cooked, drank some wine, and then went and found the cutest girl in the audience and had lunch with her.
Yeah.
I think I was part of a moment where Food Network sort of switched gears. They didn't know it was happening, like so many great things. But Food Network started, and it was the cook behind the stove. Some of the shows were more sort of imaginary than others, but when you broke it down, it was the chef or the cook and the stove and the island and
camera on the other side.
Exactly. And I'll make three dishes, and here we go. But I think that the moment that changed it for Food Network especially, and then really helped start this explosion, was when I was on Iron Chef, the original Japanese version. And there was a lot of controversy about it. Morimoto, who is my pal now, said some things about my performance having nothing to do with cooking.
Your behavior.
My behavior. Thank you.
I have to correct you on that.
Where I jumped on the cutting board. I didn't even know I was on the cutting board, which is the most ironic part.
We were in the middle of being electrocuted, if I remember correctly. You were bleeding, electrocuted, and a few other things.
Awful.
They were basically trying to kill you.
Totally.
Yeah.
And they almost accomplished it. Yeah. But my mother was crying in the audience. To this day, she's mad at Iron Chef. So anyway, sorry. So my sous chefs lifted me up on the table, and I happened to be standing on the cutting board. And lo and behold, Morimoto basically called me not a chef because I disrespected the cutting board. And in Japan, the cutting board is sacred. And on, I was like, what is going on here? But every media outlet in the world picked it up. Time Magazine, CNN, New York Times. I mean, you name it. I mean, I couldn't answer my phone.
Because you stood on a cutting board.
Because I stood on a cutting board. But what it did was, okay, I took a lot of negative hits, unfounded, I have to say, but that's okay. I took a lot of negative hits as sort of the ugly American because I stood on the cutting board. But what it did was it brought food culture and Food Network into pop culture. Right there.
Boom.
That was the moment. And as you know.
World stage.
as you know, things changed very rapidly there. There became an Iron Chef America franchise that you, of course, helm. And then shows like Top Chef. I mean, all these competition shows, let's face it.
They all come out of Iron Chef.
Iron Chef was the template.
Yep.
And it's great. It's amazing. But that, to me, was the moment.
Iron Chef. Still any fun?
When it's over. And I mean that. I don't look forward to it because it's very stressful. And people like say to me now, like, do you even think about it? I'm like, of course I think about it. Like, I'm up there. I want to win. The thing about Iron Chef is I want to win. And I don't always win, of course. And I'm totally fine when I get beat because that person, that man, that woman, whoever was in the kitchen beat me that day. And I always learn something when somebody beats me. Even when I win, I learn something from the other chefs, of course. It's so great to see how all these people how food has evolved sort of all over the country and how everybody looks at it very, very differently. I always want to win on Iron Chef. I'm always happy when it's over. The verdict, as you guys call it, is not the most important thing to me. I just want to cook good food. I want a good showing every single time. And if the other person is better, that's okay.
How much of it is you thinking that you're cooking against yourself?
All
meaning, okay, so it's never that you get beat by another chef, it's that you lose to yourself.
I don't play defense in Iron Chef, I play offense. I don't think about what the other chef's going to do.
You can't.
I can't. I mean, first of all, I barely can even glance over there.
Yeah.
As you know, I basically run for 60 minutes.
Yes.
Because I'm always concerned that I'm never going to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been moments where, I mean, I've made it every time, but there's been moments where it's really gotten down. And people sometimes say to me, oh, you just kind of play it to the end. It's not true. Like, I want to be done. I mean, I'd rather be sitting there, like, having a shot of tequila for the last 2 minutes than like, looking for the micro cilantro that I can't find. I mean,
you've had battles. You've had battles where you are still moving 10 seconds before the bell. And I've learned to watch you. And I can actually see it. I've decided that I can actually see the moment where you go interiorly, I'm done. Have there been times in Kitchen Stadium where you have thought, what am I doing? This isn't my food. What am I doing here? Ever?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes, I remember I did this fondue dish. I still think about it like every week. That was awful. I obviously lost that battle. I can't remember what it was.
What was the ingredient? Because I don't even remember the ingredient.
I don't remember.
Doesn't matter.
But, you know, and I didn't have a vessel for the fondue to be tempered at the right temperature, and it basically turned into glue. I mean, it was awful. And I mean, I'm like, how can I be serving this? But I had no choice. There's nothing I could do.
I still screw up fondue third of the time that I make it. As a matter of fact, I've kind of given up. It's just, it's voodoo. The booze just right, the starch just right, the temperature just right. You got to freaking know the fat content, the moisture
acid,
content of the cheese, and the acidity can screw you.
Mm-hmm.
The only way to make a fondue for sure is to use one half Velveeta. By God, you'll have Velveeta will bail you
exactly.
out. Exactly. But none of us want to say, well,
just
I'm using
half. Velveeta.
Yeah, Velveeta, and it'll
be happy. Put some green chilies in it. Queso, baby.
Queso. Hey, it's fondue.
What's the canned stuff that you use for queso in the South? Rotel?
Oh, Rotel tomatoes.
Yes.
Yes, we love Rotel down
That's
there.
My wife loves that.
Rotel is, it's basically chopped tomatoes with chilies in it.
Yeah.
And it's just hot enough.
Right.
And you mix that up with the cheese and you're done down South. We can't live without Rotel.
My wife asked me to make some queso, as she calls it, for some party we were having last summer. So I made a bechamel and I pumped in like some really good cheeses and then I cut up some chilies and this. And she's like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, she's like, "Melt the Velveeta and put in the can of Rotel." I'm like, "Stephanie, I can't do that.
I can't do. Do you know who I am?"
No. By the way, she wound up doing it herself because she didn't like mine. She's like, "This tastes like it tasted too natural, you know,
too natural."
She needed some chemicals in her queso. So
she'd been raised on that.
Oh yeah,
she wanted what she wanted.
Absolutely. I think that even as a cook, in my restaurants, I'm inspired by my childhood memories of food for sure. I mean, pork chops and applesauce. You know, that's what I grew up eating. That was sort of like a special Sunday meal in my house, and I pair apples and pork all the time because of it, I think, you know, in some way, shape, or form.
What are some others that you remember?
Lamb chops and mint jelly.
Yeah.
So whenever I cook lamb, I always use mint. Fresh mint, of course.
Yeah.
Not the jelly.
Not the jelly.
But, you know, I always utilize it. It's really interesting how those things really stick with you. And speaking of childhood, I was always a burger kid, cheeseburgers. So I always thought it'd be cool to open up my own burger place. And that's why Bobby's Burger Palace was born.
Well, and you had been doing the burger bashes down at South Beach for a long time.
Yeah, but that all kind of happened around the same time. You know, I started really doing some research, and you say like, research? It's burgers, fries, and shakes. Trust me, it takes research. You got to find the right meat, the right bun, the right cheeses. How to make a great shake? Not easy. You have to get the right blender, the right ice cream, the right mix. I mean, all those things in terms of, you know, making the perfect shake, the perfect burger, and the perfect fries. It all takes a lot of research, even by, you know, a chef who's got a bunch of high-end restaurants.
Do you like that research?
Love it.
Because you've talked about the research that went into stuff at the track, and now you talk about research here. Is that a thing of yours in general, is researching things?
Well, only because, Alton, I didn't learn through books.
Right, because you wrote the track.
Textbook, right. I was exactly. I had the Daily Racing Form. Textbooks were not my friend. I did not learn. I wasn't curious. I learned through life. And so when I am given a problem to solve, like how to make a perfect cheeseburger, I go off and do the sort of life research on how to do that. And I do that with anything that's put in front of me in terms of food. I do the work, I do the research, and then I learn about it practically.
You're a father of a daughter, as am I. That's a challenge in this day and age.
It's definitely a challenge. I've been lucky, knock on marble. She's been a great kid. You know, she's a teenager now, so she's got teenager issues that she has dealt with to the best of her abilities. I mean, you know, she's a girl in high school. I mean, it's rough.
Yeah.
She's got a great boyfriend.
Good.
Who I really like. You know, he's very respectful of her and she of him. And so she's got a really nice sort of romance relationship going on. And, you know, college is looking at her in the face. And we've visited a lot of schools. She lives in Connecticut. I think she wants out of the Northeast and she wants to go out west. I don't blame her. You know,
I would too.
76 every day.
Yeah.
And also, Sophie likes, she wants to be in the fashion business somehow. I would say if you combine communications with fashion, that would be Sophie's wheelhouse. So maybe marketing, maybe editing.
That's going to bring her back to New York,
public
inevitably.
Relations, yeah. But in the fashion business.
But in the fashion business. Yeah. Yeah, my daughter's only 13. We're not focused yet, but
we'll get focused.
It's really weird when you watch the body of your daughter become a woman, mm-hmm. and all the things that go with that are interesting.
That's why there are moms to deal with that stuff.
Absolutely, there are moms.
But you know, I just talk to Sophie about everything. I mean, and I mean everything. And but trust me, she doesn't want to talk to me about everything. But
because she's a teenage girl.
I talk to her, and if she doesn't want to talk back, I talk at her. Just to make her realize that I think about her every moment. I think about all the things that she deals with and that she's not alone. You know, she can reach out to her father whenever she needs to. She's got some, strong women in her life. Her mother has done a great job raising her. You know, my wife, Stephanie, they have a great relationship, so she's got a lot of people to call on.
Do you like writing books?
I do. I like writing some books more than others. I'm writing a book now about cooking at home, actually, which I'm really going to enjoy. At first, I was going to hire a photographer, and I decided not to. And Stephanie and I are going to take all the photos because I just don't want a photographer around in family time. I just don't want it. I don't want them around during Thanksgiving. I don't want my guests to feel like they have to eat something twice if they only want to eat it once for a photo.
Yeah.
We're just going to take a bunch of pictures really organically of the food, of people, of preparation. And, you know, if we take 1,000 pictures, we'll get 50 that work. I mean, that's it. I mean, so I'm really looking forward to this one.
Thanks for being here, Bobby.
Alton, you're the greatest.
Hi, food fans. It's time now here on the Alton Brown cast for me to read from my favorite food book, The Curiosities of Food, written, of course, by Mr. Simmons back in the mid-19th century, reissued now by 10 Speed Press, who I hope won't sue me for reading some of their book. I'm reading from the Rodentia, or the part about eating rodents. The marmot is in its fat state when it first retires to its winter quarters, is in very good condition, and is then killed.
and eaten in great numbers, although we may affect to despise it. Clearly tipping the hat towards some kind of, I don't know, conspiracy against marmots. I don't know, maybe because it's, you know, they sound like varmint. I don't know. And I think that's a good place to stop for today. All right, let's go to the phones and take a question. Mary, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Where are you, Mary?
I'm in Chalkwindy, North Carolina.
I love me some North Carolina. My wife is from North Carolina. What can I do for you today, madam?
Well, I have tried to do your tomato sauce recipe. I actually was cooking it while watching the episode on YouTube, and I just couldn't get it right. It was a big flop on my part. It was just so thick. It wasn't, I guess, like a traditional sauce.
That was the meat sauce and spaghetti. That recipe, not the pantry tomato sauce, but the meat sauce, right?
It's where you took the plum tomatoes in the oven and then put them through the, I guess, food mill.
Tell me the end result was just too thick. Was that it?
Yeah, it was so thick. I even put a little bit of tomato sauce in it, and it was still too thick.
Now, remind me, the tomatoes in that recipe, were those canned or did those come out of the oven?
Fresh out of the garden, out of the oven.
And what kind of tomatoes do you grow?
Roman tomatoes or plum tomatoes.
Okay. And you're pretty sure that you followed everything pretty exactly, right down to the cup of white wine and also the olive oil, the quarter cup of olive oil?
That's probably what it was.
That's really, you've got a couple of things going on in that recipe. One, the tomatoes that was formulated for grocery store tomatoes, which are fairly moist on the inside. So here's the thing. If you're using tomatoes right out of the garden, they need to be really, really ripe. Otherwise, they'll be a little on the dry side. And then you've got to remember that cup of wine and above all, that olive oil, because that olive oil actually, even though it's not water, it's oil, keeps things looser and keeps it from clotting up on itself. So that's a pretty important part of the recipe.
Thank you so much.
Sure thing. And always, you know, the thing about anytime you make a sauce with a vegetable, you got to keep in mind that there's a good bit of range of ripeness and water content in vegetables as they ripen. So it might be that your tomatoes, which might be really delicious, might also be just a little bit drier. So you always need to be ready to add a little bit more or in some cases less liquid, depending on the ripeness of those tomatoes.
Okay.
Well, thanks a lot for calling. I hope you have better luck next time.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
You bet. All right, we're going to take another call now. This is from Christina. Are you there, Christina?
Hi, Mr. Brown. How are you doing?
I'm good. What kind of question might you have for me today, madam? What do you want to talk about?
All righty. So I'm actually a chemist, and I'm an educator. And over the years, as I've been watching Good Eats and read the books that you've written, it's really clear that you've put a lot of time in to educate yourself scientifically so that you can make it really understandable for the masses. And so I wanted to know... I want to hear your comments on the lake becoming more scientifically literate and what resources you use personally other than, you know, advisors and things. You know, how did you teach yourself the science that you needed?
Well,
I was curious about that.
First, thank you for that. So I kind of got my scientific learning the amateur route, which is that I just read an awful lot. And if I had a question, I dug around until I found it. Now, before the advent of the internet, that just meant that I spent a great deal of time in libraries. And I still do. Actually, no, I don't. I have people I can send to the library now, although I think she really just goes onto Wikipedia and tells me it's from the library anyway. And she's nodding right now because she's sitting here. And so what I would do is I would dig around until I found the reference that I needed. And I became a very, very big fan of bibliographies. You know, if I could find one good food science book, like, you know, a benchmark work like Harold McGee's On Food and Cooking. And then you would see what I would basically just go to the bibliography and then just look up every one of those sources and then read those sources. And if they had bibliographies, I'd read those sources. And so you could literally in real scholarly works, you can create a whole library just by using those sources, which is what I did. And in a way, I think that my research then was better than what's available now because the internet is such a dastardly dark hole of bad information.
So bibliographies are where it's at. And, you know, magazines, if I got a magazine, you know, if I got a paper out of American Scientific or Nature and I couldn't understand it, I would just try to find somebody who could explain it to me. And I still have to do that.
That's
sometimes because there's a lot of stuff. If I'll get an article out of Nature and it's like, okay, I know every sixth word. And I'll find somebody who can explain some of the other words to me. And it's a slow process, but in the end, it's the only way I know to do it. If I had the time, I would go back to school. I'd go get a chemistry degree in a heartbeat. I would do that.
I'll be the first chemist to volunteer to translate those Nature articles for you.
Could you just start doing that? If you could just start now and every month or whatever, you could just do me a synopsis, you know, on each article and get the whole magazine down to about 10 pages for me. And that'd be fantastic.
I'd be happy to do it.
Well, thanks for doing what you do. And thanks for noticing what I do. I appreciate it. All right, Alton Brown here on the Alton Browncast. Going to take a few questions from the internet. Our askalton@altonbrown.com email box is running over. I'm going to start with one from Kate Smith. Hi, Kate. Kate asks, how can you tell if your pan is hot enough to add ingredients? This is a good question, and it plagues a lot of American cooks because the answer is so different depending on what kind of pan you're talking about, what kind of food you're going to cook, what kind of cooktop you have, and whatnot. The nice thing is that most recipes that call for something to go into a hot pan typically call for some kind of fat to be added to that pan first, either as a solid, you know, butter, typically in American cuisine now, or an oil, olive oil, canola oil, or the like. If it's oil, you'll know that it's hot enough because it kind of shimmers. You can see light. It's not like a smooth reflection anymore. It actually shimmers. And if the pan is relatively hot before the oil goes in, you'll see that. Now, if you're deep frying, then you would use a thermometer and you would simply bring the oil to whatever temperature, you know, the recipe calls for. But that's not what you're talking about here. You're talking about like a saute or a sear kind of situation. The other thing that you can do that I often do is just to splatter a little bit of water in the pan. And I typically want to see water hit and immediately kind of hiss and then and evaporate. What can be a problem, what tells me that my pan might be a little too hot, is if that bead of water hits and it just jumps around, kind of like it's not even really touching the pan. It skittles around so quickly. That tells me sometimes that the pan's too hot, certainly for something like, say, pancake batter, which I typically do in a dry skillet. The one thing that I really like butter for is that butter is a great product because it tells you a lot more than any other fat does when it goes into the pan. If I put a cold half tablespoon of butter into a hot pan, it's going to go through stages, right? First, it's going to melt. Then the water is going to cook out. So what you get is you get this foaming stage where that water is cooking out. And then once most of the water cooks out, it very quickly becomes brown butter as the solids in the remaining fat phase begin to brown. And of course, they'll eventually burn. So if I'm making omelets, for instance, or making an omelet, and I've got my little pan there, I would put it over medium heat. I put in a pat of butter. And as soon as the main foaming dies down, I add the eggs because I know that it's hot enough. So I like butter because butter tells you a lot about what is going on in the pan. The other method, of course, is simply to put your hand down onto the pan. And when the screaming starts, it's hot enough. But you might not want to try that one. This comes from Steve Emanuelson, who asked me, what is the best cooking technique or tip that you've learned from another Food Network celebrity? I did actually learn from Iron Chef Morimoto about the subtleties of using dashi, or a Japanese fish stock, and kombu, actually, with katsubushi or tuna in it. That's a pretty powerful tool that I learned to use from him. Learned how to use Batarga from Mario Batali. Batarga is pretty great stuff. It's like the dried roe of generally gray sole or a few other fish that you grate onto. It's almost like the truffle of the sea. That's some pretty great stuff. But I think I learn every time that I work on Iron Chef America, I learn some tip. I learn some small thing, how to, you know, properly blanch parsley before you make an oil out of it. I learned that from Bobby Flay. So it's a lot of little things. One of the reasons that I really like working at Food Network and why I like working on shows like Iron Chef America is that I constantly am in a state of learning.
Well, thank you for squandering some more of your precious lifetime listening to the Alton Browncast. We will be back with another episode very, very soon. And until then, America, cook smart.